Hello and welcome to Blind Prophecy, the podcast. Today we'll be discussing a dream I had which might give you some insights into my state of mind. We'll bid ta-ta for now to Reagan Fox of Fox in the City, discuss some dangerous trends with Utah laws when it comes to gay rights, meditate on the concept of righteous anger or righteous outrage, and I'll talk a bit about my concept of deity and how it relates to my spirituality. Today is Sunday, May 21st, 2006. I'm broadcasting from Big Cottonwood Park.
You know,
in
I
Salt
spent
Lake
most
City,
of my
Utah.
Adult life working
I'm
in
your
the queer press at local gay rags. I am
Thanks,
a liberal.
Welcome to the show.
I have come to think of my hometown as the city by the pestilent sea. I mean, have you smelled the Great Salt Lake lately? I've had enough of these bitter barstool queens who do nothing but complain. I mean, have you smelled the Great Salt Lake lately?
Just leave a night of drinking and drag your alcoholic ass down to your local community center to volunteer for a night.
I'm becoming more and more convinced that I don't belong in Utah. I mean, I'll just never
not
fit in here.
I'm proud to be gay. I'm also proud to be a feminist, an activist, environmentalist, a pagan, a Unitarian Universalist.
Is there anything less attractive on a gay man than the Mormon temple garments?
So why is it that the only guys who are interested in being gay by the pestilence
with me are strippers and trolls?
So what?
I am the liberal media.
So I wanted to start today by talking about a dream I had last night. I don't usually like to talk about my dreams too much because, to me, that's kind of boring to listen to somebody else ramble on about one of their dreams. But this one was rather vivid and kind of an insight into my state of mind right now. So I thought I would share it just a little bit. The dream was about Pride, which is coming up in 2 weeks, Utah Pride, and of course the pressure is on at this point to make sure I've got all my ducks in a row, so to speak, and have everything go well so that the Pride event happens without a hitch, or without at least any big hitches that other people would be aware of. So anyway, last night I had this dream where it was the day of Pride. And first of all, let me say our actual Pride grounds look nothing like the landscape of the dream. In the dream, Pride was this huge, sprawling park that butted right up against the ocean on one side and had these big roads leading into it from different directions. And in the middle of the Pride grounds was this giant hill. We're talking like Julia Roberts spinning around singing, "Climb every mountain," kind of hill. And on one side of the hill, the side facing the ocean, was a giant mansion. And the only way to get from one side of the park to the other was to go through this mansion, which, of course, would create a huge bottleneck of people, as it does in the dream. It starts off like, in my dream, it's almost time for Pride to start, and none of my vendors are there. None of them have set up. There's a bunch of booths sitting there empty because the vendors just haven't shown up yet. And apparently the parade is over, and I see, throngs of people just heading towards us on this road, on the side of the hill, further away from the ocean. So, I'm running around trying to get everything set up and make sure that I have enough volunteers in place to take tickets and things like that. Then I have to climb this giant hill, and there's one spot in the entire park where I can stand and see the entire thing. So I make it to this park, and I can see the mansion, and I can see all the empty vendor booths, and I can see the ocean and the road that leads to the park alongside the ocean. And I look down, and there are thousands of people coming along that road, and I don't have any ticket takers set up there. There are no volunteers there. So, I'm running back to Jesse and telling him, Jesse's our volunteer coordinator, I'm telling him, I need people over there right away. There are people coming in. And, by this point, hundreds of people have already passed the entrance gate. And so I'm panicking because people are getting in without paying, and that's going to ruin our budget. And Jesse, just like in real life, kind of takes everything in stride and says, okay, and starts working on it immediately. And so, I see that he's got people heading down towards that gate, and I realize, okay, that's the best I can do. I've sent volunteers. Now I need to go check on other things. So I head into the mansion to cross to the other side of the park. And I can already see that there's this massive bottleneck. And Valerie, our executive director for the center, and I meet about halfway through the thing, and she tells me there's a problem with the audio-visual equipment for the entertainment. So, you know, I'm trying to get to that, and you have to go through, like, a series of rooms in the mansion to get there. And, you know, basically we've got a guy in a little booth trying to, or a little room, surrounded by computer equipment and screens, trying to get things set up so that what he's broadcasting from that room shows on the big screen out between the mansion and the ocean. Because the whole entertainment is ruined if we can't do that, and all he can seem to get in is football. All he can get the screen outside to play is football, which, you know, most of the people at coming to Pride don't want to watch football. So, you know, I'm panicking about that, trying to stress out about that. So he tells me to go outside and check on what's going. So back I go, and you know, the layout of this mansion is such that, you know, anytime you want to get from one place to another, you have to go through this very narrow set of stairs that kind of twist back on itself. And so I'm trying to get outside, and I have to go through these stairs, and of course the crowd is all coming from the other direction. Those people who came in along the ocean route are trying to get in through that direction, get the other side of the park. So I'm fighting this huge stream of people on the stairs, and I finally make it down, and I get outside, and I see that the audiovisual equipment is still just broadcasting football. So I want to head back inside, but of course now the crowd has gotten so much worse that there's no way through. So I ask somebody, how do I get there, you know, other than using these stairs? And there's a way. I have to go through the children's garden. Now, in perfect dream logic, the children's area is this kind of tiny room tucked underneath the stairs. And, you know, so I head down that direction, and, you know, I enter this room, and there's some sort of magic to this room where all the adults become really tiny, like fairy people. So they're like, you know, they go as maybe as high as a toddler's knee. And so there are kids jumping up and down and bouncing around and screaming, and the volunteers who are in charge of that area are really tiny and can't do anything about it. But I find out the reason I have to go through the children's area is because the only other way to access this audiovisual room is to become really small, because you only can become small walking through the room in one direction. So I have to go through this room to get really small and then, like, climb this set of stairs and kind of go down this long corridor and, you know, squeeze under this door to get into the AV room. But, of course, now I'm in the AV room and I'm tiny. Like a little fairy person. The fairy at the game Pride Parade. Anyway, so I finally make it in there, and you know, we're still having the problems, and he keeps working on it. So now I have to go back out the same way, because by leaving the children's area from the same direction, I can become normal size again, and oh, it was just a mess. The whole dream, you know, filled with all of my actual volunteers, and committee chairs, acting pretty much normal, but, you know, and I'm the one who seems to sense that things are just crazy. They're not supposed to be, they're not supposed to be this way. It's supposed to be going better than this. And, you know, so now I'm once again trying to get over this giant hill and get back to where Jesse is to tell him, I need more people in the AV room and there's something going on with the children's area. And you know, the whole dream was just filled with weird images like that. The whole thing was just crazy, you know. You know, the dream went on long enough that, you know, sunset was falling, and you know, the big concert out on the ocean front was starting, and people were lining up for it, and of course everybody was just talking about how terrible Pride was, how awful it was, how it was so screwed up, and there weren't enough people to do anything, and Valerie's looking for me to yell at me because I let so many people in without paying, and now our budget's going to be ruined. How are we going to pay for this giant mansion and all this expensive AV equipment? And anyway, that was my dream last night. Like I said, it kind of indicates my state of mind right now. It's been, it's a huge project. I realize it's not the biggest project anyone's ever taken on. I realize that I have a lot of wonderful, wonderful help and supportive people, but I kind of feel like the whole burden of success on this event is resting on my shoulders, and it's a little overwhelming right at the moment. Valerie keeps telling me that I'm doing a great job and that my little moments of panic are, you know, unfounded, because she has complete faith, and she's telling me how last year she was so very stressed out when we were this close to Pride, and this year she feels really comfortable, like we've got everything ready to go, And so, anyway, yeah, I hope you guys will come out to Utah Pride in 2 weeks, and if you're, you know, anywhere nearby. And I'm sorry, it's not going to be on the ocean. We are a landlocked state here in Utah. if the dream landscape of Pride were there, it would be such a beautiful event, but that's just the dream landscape. Our actual event is much smaller than that, much more manageable than that. And I'm sure it'll go off just fine, despite the subconscious fears I have going on in my dreams. So I heard yesterday, in listening to my usual stream of podcasts that I listen to, that Reagan Fox from Fox in the City has decided to take an indefinite hiatus. And that kind of... if Reagan's listening, and I don't know that you are, but if you happen to hear this, Reagan, I want you to know that you were one of the inspirations for me to take up podcasting. I got my first iPod last year at Christmas, and it was a couple weeks before I discovered podcasts and kind of got hooked immediately. And one of the first ones that I listened to that just really, really impressed me was Fox in the City. And the reason was because, you know, for those who don't know, Reagan Fox is, he describes himself as a caustic power bottom, and, you know, he's just very outspoken. He's a poet, just recently got his doctorate degree, and very articulate, very hilarious. I wish I could be as entertaining as Reagan Fox. I'm not. I don't do the funny voices and all the sound editing that he does to create just a really amazing show. And I know he was feeling very uninspired, or at least he said that one of the reasons he decided to take this indefinite hiatus is because he's feeling uninspired and like he's locked into a persona. And it's really quite a shame. I completely understand and respect when people need to take a break from something and try to kind of reconnect and refocus what they started out to do. And, you know, he will be missed. He is, like I said, one of a handful of podcasters, queer podcasters, who inspired me to get started doing this not too long ago. It's a shame. I know he will still be, he said he would still be involved with Eat This Hot Show, a show that several queer podcasters put on together. And it's a good show, but it doesn't, for me, it's not as great as Fox in the City was. Fox in the City is where Reagan really opened up about a lot of political issues, a lot of thinking in queer culture that really I agreed with probably 95% of what he said. Even when he was saying it in a mean-spirited or kind of caustic way, it was still hilarious, and I saw the underlying point, and I agreed with it quite a bit. And like I said, I kind of just said, well, you know, here's a guy who has something to say and a voice, and he's saying it. And you know, I have something to say, and I have a voice, but I'm not saying it in the same way. I mean, I have my blog, I have other outlets that I like to speak on, but, you know, he's kind of the person who inspired me that this medium of podcasting can be a really great thing. So, Reagan, I hope you take the time off you need and you know, reconnect with figuring out what you want to do with podcasting if you ever decide to return to Fox in the City. And I hope you do. I hope that you kind of figure it out and decide you want to come back to it, maybe with a little bit more perspective on what you want to do so that you don't feel as uninspired or locked into a persona. I should also mention there are a couple other queer podcasters who were inspirational to me. One of them is David from Queer Media the Podcast, I believe is it called. Oh, I'm sorry, David, if I got that wrong. David is, to my knowledge, the only other queer podcaster in Utah. I discovered his podcast fairly early on, and I've never met him in real life, but I kind of become a fan since discovering his podcast and enjoy listening to it. And I feel that there need to be more Utah queer podcasters than just David and I. And there might be, and I just haven't found them yet. So if you know of any other queer Utah podcasters, send me a link so I could add them to my iTunes subscriptions, because I really like to hear what queer people in Utah have to say about different things. And then, of course, there are others. There are, Dio's Shadow, which is talking about pagan issues. Very inspirational to me, very hilarious, and a very well-produced show. He has different segments ranging from humorous co-hosts to very probing and meaty interviews with pagan authors and philosophers. So Dio's Shadow is another of my favorite podcasts. I do enjoy Feast of Fools, although I don't always listen to the entire podcast because they kind of tend to be long, and I know so do mine. But I typically listen to a podcast while I'm in the car on the way to work or on the way home or somewhere, and it's hard for me to just pick up in where I left off when I get back in the car to head in a different direction. So I don't always hear the whole Feast of Fools, but it's a fun show, and I enjoy that one as well. And there are, of course, others, but I'll stick to those for now, and I'll give my podcast shout-outs again in another episode. So another topic I want to discuss today is there's been quite a bit in the news lately about gay and lesbian laws in the state of Utah. And it seems like, by all accounts, we're having a banner year here in Utah. After nearly 10 years of being subject to message bills and anti-gay legislation and, you know, horrible politics as far as the gay and lesbian community is concerned, or queer community, I should say, it seems like we're finally having a really good year. We got the hate crime bill passed, as I've mentioned. Salt Lake City is now offering insurance and partner benefits for adults living together. And there was one anti-gay bill that passed the legislature this year. It had to do with the doctrine of in loco parentis. And the whole reason this bill was passed was because a little over a year back, a lesbian was awarded visitation rights to the non-biological daughter, the biological daughter of her ex-partner, who no longer considers herself to be a lesbian. And this bill, the courts had ruled that under the doctrine of in loco parentis, which means like a parent or having a parental relationship, the courts ruled that under this doctrine, Carrie Jones was, of course, allowed to carry on a visitation relationship with the daughter that they had started to raise together. And some very right-wing, conservative Christian lawyers went to court to fight this, and it's still working its way through the courts. But, during the legislative session, one of our one of our most anti-gay legislators, I should say, LeVar Christensen, proposed this bill that would change the whole doctrine of in loco parentis to say that the biological parents' feelings always trump anything else, that biological parents' feelings trump anybody who doesn't have a biological tie to a child. And it passed by a narrow majority, but thanks to the hard work of a lot of people, not just queer people, but everyone, Utah's Republican Governor John Huntsman Jr. vetoed the bill. And his rationale for vetoing the bill was a sound one. He said that, this is going to affect step-parents, it's going to affect grandparents, it's going to affect all sorts of non-traditional families in bad ways. The biological parent doesn't always know what's best, and sometimes they use children and custody and visitation with those children as a spiteful way of getting back at someone they feel that has wronged them. So he vetoed the bill, but the thing that I'm noticing about all of these bills, like I said, by all accounts, we're having this banner year for gay and lesbian politics. Even the Salt Lake County, after last year shooting down a domestic partner bill, it was in the Tribune earlier this week that they're considering it again. Jenny Wilson, a Democrat from Salt Lake County, which is different from Salt Lake City, is considering reproposing the bill based on the court ruling that Salt Lake City's domestic partner law was, in fact, valid. So they're planning to reopen that thing. But what I'm reading over and over again is that with the hate crime bill, with Salt Lake City and Salt Lake County's domestic partner bills, the in loco parentis veto, the rationale behind all of these things is very much about, this isn't about gay rights, it's about everyone. And you know, we only seem to be able to get a political win if we can keep the dialogue away from gay and lesbian issues. You know, the in loco parentis bill, when John Huntsman Jr. signed or vetoed it, he said that he would be willing to look at a different bill, more narrowly drawn, that wouldn't have ramifications beyond what was kind of the intended scope. Meaning to say that, you know, he's okay with discriminating against gays and lesbians, but we got to make sure that's the only people do anything bad to. The hate crime bill, as I've discussed already several times on this podcast, you know, the whole thing about the only reason we got it passed was because we took sexual orientation out of it. We took all the protected classes out of it, because if we had tried to leave the so-called laundry list in, the Republican majority would have just stripped sexual orientation and passed the rest of the bill as is, and, you know, it would be a dead issue. And so the only way we could include sexual orientation was to take that whole laundry list out. And with the Salt Lake City domestic partner bill, Mayor Rocky Anderson very clearly said that he wanted this to be about gay and lesbian partners and recognizing them. And so his bill was his executive order that originally started this was very narrowly defined to say that it's about gay and lesbian couples, gay and lesbian relationships. And the city council didn't like that so much. They changed it to say it's about any adults living together, that, you know, it can be roommates, it can be siblings who are living together for an indefinite period. It can be, you know, complete strangers for all they care. You know, just people who are living together indefinitely can get this benefit. And they thought that was the most fair way. And you know, they made some good arguments. You know, one of the arguments they made was it's about providing more health care to more people who wouldn't necessarily have access to it. And I'm a big proponent of let's give health care to as many people as we possibly can. But, you know, Rocky's bill was very much about trying to recognize gay and lesbian relationships as valid. The city council was trying to avoid recognizing gay and lesbian relationships as valid and trying to do it from more, you know, public policy of, well, healthcare is good standpoint. And, you know, the article about Salt Lake County talking about domestic partnership is very much along those lines. You know, they're saying, well, you know, based on how things worked out for the city, I think if we were to present it that way, we could get this to pass. And the Salt Lake County has a very slim Republican majority. It's 5-4, five Republicans, 4 Democrats at the county level. And when the bill was defeated last year, it was defeated right along party lines. It was, you know, 5 Republicans voting against, 4 Republicans voting for. And some of the Republicans who voted against it were very emotionally torn up about it. They didn't want to send a message that they disrespected anyone, but they felt that, you know, because of Amendment 3 and so, you know. So now they're saying, well, if we can present it again saying this isn't about gay and lesbian issues, maybe it'll pass this time. I have to say, I am sick to my stomach when I think that the only way that we can win equality is to stop talking about ourselves. I understand the realities of political compromise. I understand that, you know, sometimes to build alliances and to get something passed, being visible is the worst thing that we can do, to kind of rub people's face in who we are, so to speak, which I have a problem with that whole concept. But anyway, not to get off topic, you know, I just have this big problem with saying that, you know, we'll give you rights so long as you shut up and don't make this a big deal. You know, it's almost like, you know, oops, we unintentionally gave rights to queer people. Ooh, sorry, we didn't mean to. Are people really that stupid? Are voters that stupid that, you know, they're going to look at these kind of bills and say, oh, they accidentally benefited queer people as well. That wasn't intended, but, you know, it's a good bill, but, gosh, it benefits those queer people as well. Well, I guess we can't get upset about that. Or do our politicians really think that people are so outraged about, you know, any kind of advancement in queer rights that anything that is perceived to be about gay rights is immediately going to get them voted out of office? I don't think that's the case. I think if that were the case, Rocky Anderson would not have won his re-election bid a couple years ago. If I think that were the case, there are a lot of Democrats who would not be in office now. But I think the Democrats in particular are playing this bad game of let's not make it about queer issues, let's make it about something else that people can generally agree to. And what the danger in this is that, again, with a few more Republicans in any of these seats, or I guess I should say ultra-conservatives, because there are some very moderate and friendly Republicans, with a few more ultra-conservatives in these seats, somebody could come along and say, oh, well, this domestic partner law, great, but, you know, it benefited queer people, and we're not okay with that. So we're going to change it now to say that we only want to give these to opposite gender couples living together indefinitely. Or people who can prove some sort of legal relationship. Because there is no recognized legal relationship between a gay and lesbian couple. There's a legal relationship between sisters. There's a legal relationship between, all sorts of other people, but grandparents or whomever, and so I could see them changing it to say, we'll recognize heterosexual couples or people in legal relationships, but, this bill unintentionally benefited queer people, and we can't have that. And I could see it becoming very much election year politics with people looking to bash the fags again, at least to the electorate, so that, they can get that ultra-evangelical Mormon, vote out. So anyway, that's the danger I see in this. I see a danger in making us invisible as though, our issues don't matter. It sends a message. It sends a message to people that, the best way to be gay is to be quiet about it. It's nobody's business but my own kind of thinking. That would be great if it were true, but it is other people's business sometimes. I mean, no, they shouldn't be able to tell you what to do, but, we only put down discrimination when we're all visible and outspoken about who we are and not willing to suffer in silence. The worst thing that could happen would be the making the queer community invisible again. We've enjoyed unprecedented visibility in the last several decades, more so in the last 10 years than any other time in human history. Can you imagine prior to 10 years ago people even talking about gay marriage, much less having shows on TV about gay and lesbian people? So the worst thing that could happen is to fall into this right-wing trap of making ourselves invisible in our quest for rights, in backing away and saying, no, this isn't about us. This is about the greater good. It's about giving health care to more people, not about just us. That could backfire on us big time. So I just think we should be very careful when we accept these sorts of arguments from people for, doing something that is very queer positive. And we should say, hooray, that's very queer positive, good for you, rather than saying, oh, well, it actually benefits us too. I know that wasn't the intention. So anyway, I've rambled on about this enough. I'm worried. I feel like right now we could get marriage laws, marriage equality, if we could somehow prove that it didn't benefit primarily gay and lesbian people. If we could pass a bill that allowed any two consenting adults to get married, but somehow make it out so that it wasn't about gay and lesbian people, I feel like maybe we could pass that right now. And the gay and lesbian component would just be a quote-unquote accidental side effect. Something else I wanted to talk to about today is anger issues. I'm typically a kind of easygoing person. It's hard to get me riled up about something to where I'm physically angry, as I think I've mentioned before. But as Pride gets closer, I kind of naturally find myself getting busier and more nervous this is to be expected, of course, and I knew that the stress levels would be high on this job. I knew I'd be facing criticism from people I've never met, unrealistic demands from people who have, from their point of view, perfectly reasonable requests, and pressure from people like board of directors and our executive director, who build up expectations that are sometimes beyond my comfort level. If you add this to the escalating list of deadlines to meet, facts and details to remember, opportunities to make critical mistakes, and the never-ending distractions that prevent any job from being completed in one sitting, and, well, I think you can guess why I want to talk a little bit about anger today. My temper has been short, although I do my best to keep it to myself rather than taking it out on unexpected people. Of course, I recognize that the type of anger I'm referring to here is condemned far and wide as unhealthy and destructive. There are no shortage of pithy comments from religious and political leaders, poets and philosophers, psychologists and scientists, which point to the spiritual, physical, and interpersonal poison that results from anger such as this. But there's another kind of anger that has been on my mind lately, and it's not new. It's not a result of the increased stress from Pride, but it's something that kind of has always driven me. For lack of a better phrase, I want to call this righteous anger. I cringe at the phrase because it had become associated with zealots and hate mongers in this modern age. The righteous anger that I'm speaking of would never be mistaken for one of those God hates fags types. Fred Phelps and his Westboro Baptist Church. But anyway, there's a quote that I like. It reads, "Anger may be foolish and absurd, and one may be irritated when in the wrong, but a man never feels outraged unless in some respect he is at bottom right." Excuse me. I like that. That's a quote from Victor Hugo, the noted French author. So I want to drop the connotation-heavy phrase righteous anger and say righteous outrage instead, at least for now. Because I like that idea that the outrage is something that a man never experiences unless in some respect he is at bottom right or in the right. My religious experience has been contradictory on the subject of righteous outrage or righteous anger. I've heard stories from my LDS Christian upbringing about Jesus the pacifist who taught us to turn the other cheek. At the same time, I've heard stories about the outraged Jesus who stormed the temple driving out the vendors and den of thieves. The sermons of Unitarian Universalism often talk about turning anger into love, a very Buddhist principle. The Dalai Lama has been pretty clear on this topic, that anger is never positive, and through discipline we strive to remain happy and serene instead. I find that in a lot of liberal faith traditions, and not so liberal faith traditions, but in a lot of faith traditions, we kind of frown on anger or outrage as a negative, bad thing. You know, it ruins us from being, or it keeps us from being happy and serene. I remember reading this book by Starhawk, The 12 Wild Swans, and I don't have the exact passage in front of me now, unfortunately, but there's this point where she's talking about the young woman who's growing up in a castle, and she just senses that something is wrong. And the story is that her 12 older brothers, in an ill wish, were turned into swans so that her mother could have one daughter. And so she's growing up in this house, and nobody ever talks about the 12 brothers who turned into swans and disappeared, but she senses that there's something wrong, and she can't quite put her finger on it. And when she learns of what's wrong, she realizes, well, I didn't make this mistake. You know, I'm not the one who made this bad decision, but it's up to me to set it right. And, you know, I feel that there's probably a level of outrage in arose in the story in deciding that it's up to her to set it right. You know, she's outraged that the world would be so unfair, that her mother would make such a bad wish, that you know, people could be punished for things that weren't their fault, and there's something wrong with the world. It's outrage. You know, if she just wanted to be happy and serene, she would just kind of accept it and go, oh, well, I didn't cause the problem, and you know, it's not my fault, and oh well. But that's not how she feels. She feels this is wrong. There's something fundamentally wrong about this. So she sets out to find a way to save her brothers from being swans. And so I've kind of always liked that passage from the book 12 Wild Swans. It really inspired me to be an activist. It's not what inspired me to be an activist, but the book was given to me by one of my earliest activist friends, Liz Moore. She and I were the staff on the No On 2 campaign back in the 2000 Nevada election, trying to defeat the passage of their anti-gay amendment. And she gave me the book because, she said the average lifespan of a activist, a grassroots activist, is 3 years. They burn out. They lose interest in the cause, or they get offended or something, and so they just burn out and they drift away. So she gave me the book saying, this book is about how to find a spiritual core that'll keep that fire alive. And, you know, really, it did exactly that. And I am forever indebted to Liz for having introduced me to that book and that concept of finding a spiritual core to keep me motivated in my political and personal activism. So there's another quote that I kind of like from Zach Della Roca from Rage Against the Machine. Your anger is a gift, or at least it's attributed to him. Nobody's sure if he quite made it up. I like that. The anger can be a gift. Very much flies in the face of Buddhist serenity and happiness teachings, very much flies in the face of a lot of religious teachings I've grown up with. And I don't want to say, let's turn this into jihad-type anger, because reason must always be a part of the anger. And again, this is why I like the word outrage a little bit better. Anger implies that you're not thinking. Anger implies that you're so emotional that you're not being rational anymore. But outrage means that you've thought this through, that you've seen, firsthand accounts of things that just are unacceptable, and you know in your heart fundamentally that you're in the right. And it's not about losing your temper. It's not about, doing things out of anger. It's about realizing that there's a great injustice or a great wrong in the world and stepping up to do something about it. This kind of righteous anger, the kind of righteous anger I'm talking about, a righteous outrage, it's a very proactive thing. You can't feel righteous outrage and do nothing. As if you do, you're just feeling anger. If you do nothing about it, you're just feeling anger. You're letting your emotions control you. When you feel the kind of righteous outrage I'm referring to, it's much more, the word fire in your belly, as cliche as that may be, it feels like the right words to be using to me. There's a song from the musical Ragtime that I really, really love. It's at the end of Act One, called A Day of Peace. And in this song, Cole House, one of the central characters, his girlfriend, mother of his child, has just been killed basically by bigotry and prejudice and stereotype. She was trying to get help and got shot. The song begins with this anguished, huge no coming out of Cole House, and they start to sing, and they sing about there's a day of peace, a day of hope, but it's not, but we can never rest until we reach that day. And it's got these very angry characters. Cole House is one of them. In the play, Cole House goes on to do something very destructive and very bad. He, becomes a terrorist, essentially. But there are these other angry characters in there, like a brother is one of the characters, and, he also kind of drifts towards the terrorist thing, but I think that his intentions are much more honorable the whole way through. I mean, he doesn't want to do something bad, but he wants to fix the problem. He recognizes this great injustice, and You know, and in the song there are characters screaming out things like, she was somebody's child, she had feelings and a soul, and people are just getting so worked up about this, and they all go off and in different ways kind of change because of this experience. They some of them feel this righteous outrage, and some of them feel just anger and very destructive anger. There's another quote that I love from Jeff Greenleaf. A man is measured by the size of things that anger him. And I love that. I love the idea that, you know, a man is measured by the size of the things that anger him. If you are angered by little things, if you're angered by somebody calling you a name, and you know, like my little brother Jordan, the one who's handicapped, yesterday he was very, very angry because somebody had called him a name. And, you know, he couldn't get past it to, realize that it was just joking and teasing. And so he was very, very upset because he couldn't recognize it for lighthearted teasing that wasn't intended seriously. When somebody calls me a faggot, I feel, a different kind of anger than, if somebody calls me a jackass. When somebody calls me a jackass, especially in kind of a teasing way, that's one thing. When somebody calls me a faggot, that's systematic of a much bigger problem. It's a problem of social magnitude as opposed to an interpersonal, relationship. So, and things like that, are you angry because the traffic isn't moving, or are you angry because we're destroying the environment with all of these gas-guzzling SUVs on the road? Are you angry because, you stubbed your toe? Are you angry because people are being put to death in Iraq just for being gay, and our country is giving lip service to saying it's bad, but in reality just turning a blind eye to it? And that's the kind of thing that I think is important, is what are you angry about? How big a concept is your anger? Is your anger or outrage focused on little things that really, in the grand scheme of things, don't mean that much? Is your life going to be that much worse because you stubbed a toe, or you're stuck in traffic, or somebody's called you a name? Or are you angry because of these huge social problems that really, demand a response bigger than just you? That's kind of just like some of the thoughts been running around through my head lately on the subject of anger. I think everything that I do as a queer activist is in some part inspired by this righteous outrage, this looking around and seeing injustice in the world and wanting to do something about it. Now, I have a lot of friends here in Utah who have a problem with quote-unquote victim mentality. People who get so tired of the gay and lesbian community acting like victims, who think that any time we stand up to the dominant culture, or any time we harp on things like the teen suicide rates, or the excommunication policies of the LDS Church, or families rejecting people, they say, well, these people are choosing to be victims. You can choose to be a victim, but you can also choose to be not a victim by standing up to this sort of thing. It's not enough to just serenely kind of go, oh, well, that's the way it is, and let it go. I think you're still a victim if you let things like that stand. I think that letting things go and saying, oh, well, there's nothing I can do about it, or, well, that's just the way they feel, and I guess I have to accept that they feel that way, but I'm not going to let them get to me, that's still being a victim, if you ask me. You're being a victim if you aren't actively a soldier for the other side, so to speak. And God, I hate words that are so loaded with connotation and language, but if you're not actually doing something to fix the problem, you're part of the problem. Once again, falling into cliche territory, but I really do believe that to be true. I really do believe that, you can criticize people who take on victim mentality, and I would too. People who just feel that everything in their life has gone wrong is somebody else's fault. Well, yeah, that's a little much. You know, you got to take some responsibility for yourself. But part of taking responsibility for yourself is also taking responsibility for others, if you ask me. I keep saying if you ask me. But I like this concept that being responsible for yourself, being not a victim, means taking on responsibility for other people who maybe like you, or maybe aren't like you. Maybe people who don't have the ability to see things from your perspective, which has brought you a measure of peacefulness and serenity. So I think it's really important when you feel this kind of righteous outrage. You don't want to be a victim. You don't want to let what they do dictate your life. But at the same time, if you're not taking responsibility for yourself and for others, you're just contributing to the problem. I think the best way to get out of victim mentality is to actually actively do something for other people. So it's kind of, some of the thoughts have been running through my head. And it's kind of very disjointed right now. I'm not a professional philosopher like others who can put all their thoughts together in a very clear and ordered manner, but it just seems important to me, like this whole concept of being a victim and anger and activism, they're all tied together on some fundamental level. And that's, kind of my feelings on the righteous outrage. I don't think I would be doing, pride work if I didn't feel some sort of outrage at, the larger heterosexism of our culture. I don't think I would be podcasting if I didn't feel like there is some level of outrage at the misinformation and wrong thinking kind of things that the bigotry and bias that I hear out there, and I kind of hope that in some way this helps to change things just a little bit, even if only one person hears it. So we just have a few minutes left for the time limit I've kind of set for myself today. And the last thing I wanted to talk about was a little bit on my concept of spirituality. I've mentioned a couple times now that I consider myself a Unitarian Universalist pagan. And, I think that needs a little bit more explanation. And it's not something I'm going to be able to explain in one sitting, but maybe I can start with some of the basic concepts I hold dear, to give you an idea or a basis to start from as we get into more detailed discussions down the line. So it fundamentally boils down to me to concepts of deity. I have a concept of deity that is kind of ever-expanding, that is kind of ever-growing. And I'm constantly looking for ways to grow this concept of deity. When I was young, I grew up with this very, God the Father, Jesus Christ and the Holy Ghost, Christian concept of deity. And, in Mormon teachings, and I don't know, I can't speak anymore to how much this is a completely church doctrine and how much it's just hearsay, but in the Mormon tradition I grew up in, I was taught that, there was a heavenly father and there was a heavenly mother, although we never talked to her or about her. And this is done, quote-unquote, out of respect, that God doesn't want, or heavenly father doesn't want heavenly mother bothered with all of our concerns and prayed to, that as the priesthood holder man of the family, he should be the one dealing with our problems, and we show respect to her by honoring her silently, and what that amounts to is most people don't even think about the concept of heavenly mother unless it comes up. But anyway, beyond the obvious sexism of this, my early childhood concept of deity kind of included a god and goddess figure. And when I left the Mormon church when I was 17, I kind of floundered around for a bit. I went very agnostic or atheist, depending on you know, the day, about the whole concept of deity before finally deciding that I needed to look into it again. So I looked into a couple traditional Christian churches from Catholicism and various types of Protestantism, and just found that already their concept of deity was too small for me. You know, their concept of God was too small, too narrow. You know, God is this, you know, white man with a beard who, you know, also is Jesus and also is the Holy Ghost and the whole Trinity thing, which just, you know, it didn't quite work for me. I wasn't buying it. So then I looked into a couple other things, Buddhism for a little while, and I never really understood the notion of deity within Buddhism. It was a concept which at the time was too large for me, I think, and, you know, I'm still to this day not sure I grasp it, and I wouldn't claim to. But, you know, through stumbling through a couple different religions, I eventually kind of landed on paganism, which went back to the concept of God and goddess, and kind of a pantheistic worldview. Specifically, I started with Wicca, and still consider myself to be primarily Wicca-based in my beliefs. But, you know, it's a much more pantheistic view in, you know, the different aspects of God and goddess represented by these different gods, you know, from the Greek gods to the Norse gods to African gods, you know, Native American Indian spirits, you know, all that sort of stuff, you know, could be made to fit within this concept of Wicca and paganism. And even within Wicca, I find myself kind of running up into a wall, because when it gets right down to it, the concept of God and goddess is in itself kind of a very small and limiting perspective on deity. And to me, deity is so much larger than that. I was recently explaining to my friend, in my life, I know transgender people, I know intersex people or hermaphroditic people, people who are born with both gender organs. I don't actually know any asexual people, but, you know, there are asexual things found in nature. You know, there are amoebas that, you know, clone themselves by, you know, cellular division. And there are, you know, just so many variations on even the concept of gender that, you know, God and goddess feels kind of limiting to me. I kind of see deity as having aspects of, you know, there are obviously a lot of men and a lot of women in the world. So, you know, those are very strong aspects of deity, but I wouldn't want to dismiss the aspects of deity that are male to female transgender and female to male transgender, and the aspects of deity which are intersexed, and the aspects of deity which are asexual, and the aspects of deity which are, you know, the kind of more rare medical anomalies of like XXY or XXXY chromosomes, or, you know, XXXX, or, you know, whatever, all the variations that can happen there. So I don't want to dismiss those concepts of deity either. So, you know, I read this article a while back. My friend Ajlin gave it to me as part of a class we were taking at UU. And one of the things it said in there is that man is essentially a social animal. When you're looking at man in the relationship to nature, well, of course, humankind is an animal. It is part of nature. And they said, what kind of sets us apart from other animals is that we're a social animal. And our ability to communicate is founded not so much on language, but on our ability to read the expressions and personalities of each other. Our ability to understand each other. And they talked about how early pagan mythologies regarding gods and goddesses and whatnot were really extensions of this evolutionary knack we have for reading the emotions and expressions and words and meanings of each other. Like, you know, when you look out at the sea, when you look at the ocean, it's such an incredibly vast thing and encompasses so much. How do you wrap your mind around that? Well, as human beings, what we do really well is read emotions and expressions. So we personify the sea. We look at the roaring sea and we say, oh, the sea is angry. We've personified it. The sea can't be angry. The sea is not a thing that can be angry, but we personify it and give it a personality and give it a godhood status, so that, that God who looks like us or is more like us and whose expressions we can read and whose, words we can understand, we've given it now a form that we can link onto, that we can understand better. And that's where the beginning of this narrowing of deity happens, is we look at natural phenomena that are beyond our scope of understanding and narrow it down and personify it to give it a shape that we understand. And, I think that's true of almost any concept of deity that is taught by any kind of religion, that, the whole of deity, the whole of whatever guiding force there is to the universe, however you want it, higher power, God, goddess, whatever you want to call it, the whole of it is so incomprehensible to us that in order to grasp any of it, we have to make it smaller. We have to make it fit into these human shapes. And even if we can get beyond the human shapes, we're still putting it into some kind of a shape. We're looking at all of nature as deity, but deity goes beyond just, all of nature. It encompasses so much more than that. And, we just simply cannot ever hope to fathom everything. So that's why, I have an ever-expanding concept of deity. Every time I encounter something new in the natural world or in science or among people that I had never thought of before, I add that to my concept of deity. Whether it's a new way of animals reproducing or a new way of understanding nature or science, these things I add to my concept of deity instead of saying they don't fit with my concept of deity, so there must be something wrong with my concept of deity. A lot of people, when they get into that kind of thinking, they lose their faith. And for me, it's more about expanding my faith, finding more about deity to respect and admire. So, anyway, I can't find a religion better suited to this sort of thinking than paganism, and particularly paganism within the UU Church. Because I don't think there's anything wrong with the Christian God. I don't think there's anything wrong with Hindu gods. I don't think there's anything wrong with Buddhism. I don't think there's anything wrong with humanism and looking at things from an atheist perspective. And as such, UUism, Unitarian Universalism, really embraces just about any kind of spiritual path, including those that people wouldn't necessarily think of as spiritual paths, like humanism and atheism. And it teaches from different religious traditions. And I can find nothing but value in that, in continuing to expand on my notion of deity. And paganism appeals to me in that it gives me a way to channel this concept into worship through ritual, through magic, through, those sorts of things. It gives me a very admittedly small way to worship and respect this deity. But still, nonetheless, a way to do that doesn't preclude my understanding of deity, that doesn't force me to narrow my, or make smaller my concept of deity in any way, shape, or form. So, that's kind of why I call myself UU Pagan, because it's, really the path that most makes sense in terms of my concept and my relationship with deity. How I interact with it and how I hope to understand it and expand on my understanding of it. So anyway, like I said, not going to go into all of the craziness of my spiritual beliefs right now, because that would take us hours and hours and hours. But that's just a little part of kind of some groundwork that we can build on in future podcasts. So anyway, I really hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, drop by tiresias.blogspot.com. Leave me a comment letting me know that you're out there listening. Maybe put your picture up on the Frapper map. Again, that's Tiresias, tiresius.blogspot.com. You can also check out my regular blog at tiresias.livejournal.com, where I write and rant about all sorts of other things. There's also usually a bunch of pick spam up there. And then if you want you and you don't want to log into either of those sites, you can, of course, send me an email, which is ATP, as in all things philosophical, _Tiresias@yahoo.com. Again, that's ATP_Tiresias@yahoo.com. Thanks so much for listening. I'm recording this from Big Cottonwood Park in Salt Lake City, Utah. And I want to thank you all for listening. Please drop me a note and let me know that you're out there. I know a few people have come to me and told me they were listening in person already, and I appreciate that. but if you're not local, if you don't know me, please do send a note. And again, this is your host, Tiresias, for the Blind Prophecy Podcast, wishing you happy days full of pride.